From Louisiana to California, Missouri to Washington, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the American Legislative Exchange Council has released its annual Rich States, Poor States report on the economic competitiveness of each state. Report co-author Jonathan Williams is here with details. $22 trillion. That is the record amount of the national debt. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth is here with the real story on that dubious milestone. Former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz is considering a run for the presidency as an independent. But could he become the Libertarian Party's nominee? Eric Boehm and Matt Welch of Reason Magazine explore that option. And President Trump has declared the United States will never be a socialist nation. But many in the Democrat Party clearly disagree. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Each year, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, publishes a report on policies related to economic competitiveness in the 50 states. Jonathan Williams is chief economist at ALEC, and he is vice president of the Center for State Fiscal Reform. He is co-author of Rich States, Poor States, and he is here now to talk about this year's report. Jonathan, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jonathan, before we start talking about the findings of the Rich States, Poor States report, tell us a little bit about the report. What is it? How did it get started? And what are you researching and finding?
Well, this report's now been around since 2007, and Art Laffer, of course, of Ronald Reagan fame as economic advisor, and Stephen Moore and I have put it together for these more than a decade now to give state legislators and concerned citizens across the country a way to measure their state to how it ranks economically, both in how it's done over the last decade, as well as, more importantly, where that state is headed and how competitive that state's policies are for future job creation and economic growth. And what we've really found is over these now 10, 12 years that we've been putting together the report, not only are states and state lawmakers paying attention and listening to the findings of the report, is that the states have followed the framework, becoming more free market, lower tax, more freedom oriented as a state, are seeing and enjoying the economic results of those actions, while the states on the other side of the spectrum that have been following the tax and spend approach continue to have major problems economically.
And as you develop the report, what sort of factors go into it?
We have 15 different factors that we measure in Rich States, Poor States, and while you can, Loman, see probably 1,000 different things that you could rank states on, and we see all these rankings out there today, we chose these 15 for a couple of big reasons. First of all, we know that these 15, such as taxes and labor policy and regulation, are things that matter directly to the bottom line of a state, to the economic competitiveness of the state. We know this from the academic research, from small business input, from the long tenure of research of Arthur Laffer. But more importantly, perhaps even, and we see all these rankings that measure things that are very, very difficult to actually put a price tag on, things like quality of life or weather or things like that. Now, while they matter for people, we know that state legislators in the 50 state capitals only can control public policy. And so that's why everything that we measure in Rich States, Poor States, we know has a proven impact on economic competitiveness, but also there are things that state legislators have direct control over as part of their legislative duties.
You, of course, have been doing this, as you've pointed out, for a number of years now. And let's take a look at your most latest report, which, of course, encompasses 2018. What were the important developments that you noticed in 2018 relative to where the states were a year or two earlier?
Well, one of the big things that we've noticed in the last year is just how good of a picture things are now at the state legislative level for budgets and economics. We have seen, and this is due to a couple of different things, but because of, A, the economic recovery since the start of the Trump administration and because of many, many good policies such as tax cuts and regulatory relief coming out of Washington, D.C., very few states are facing budget problems since it's a big reversal from just a couple of years ago, Loman, where we saw the majority of states facing red ink in some cases during the very slow economic recovery after 2008 in the Obama years. And this has been a huge turnaround now, where we saw only about a handful of states starting out 2019 with a budget deficit. And what that's meant is there's been a lot of discussions about tax cuts. There's been a lot of discussions about how to make the states more competitive. But on the other side, those that would like to spend all of those extra dollars and take advantage of this windfall, they would like to spend it on lots of different projects. And so that's really been one of the big debates across state capitals in the last year. And we talk about it in depth in the first chapter of Rich States, Poor States, is how federal tax reform has impacted the states. And now there's this existential debate over whether you spend the extra money or whether you give it back to hardworking taxpayers, as I think everyone that was involved with the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act would like to see.
As we look at the impact of the fact that, Jonathan, the states have more money available because of the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and the fact that people are actually getting to keep more of their money, as we look at that, have any states made definitive decisions yet as to what they are going to do with the additional revenue that we see coming into many state coffers, or is it all still in the discussion stage?
Well, certainly we've seen some fantastic wins for the free market side in the states over the last 12 months after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And what it meant was, for the states that have income taxes, they generally start with federal adjusted gross income as well. And what that meant was, when the federal tax base was broadened, the states had all this extra money. And what we saw was, in the first few months of 2018 even, we saw several states enact historic tax relief and tax reform efforts of their own, such as Iowa and Missouri, bordering states that know what it means to become more competitive. We saw Idaho. We saw Georgia. States across the country have utilized this really once-in-a-generation opportunity of having these extra dollars that were unbudgeted, which is so important, and they're ongoing. So they had these dollars sitting there, and they used them to buy down personal and corporate income tax rates, to enhance standard deductions, personal exemptions, things to reduce their tax burden and make their tax codes more competitive. So that was the untold story of federal tax reform. We know the benefits, what it meant at the federal level, but outside of the Beltway, since nobody really covers state capitals anymore when it comes to the mainstream media, we have all of these great free market success stories, and the big beneficiaries, of course, Loman, are the hardworking men and women, the taxpayers of those states that will see a much different and much lower tax burden in the years ahead.
And Jonathan, one of the components of the Rich States, Poor States report is you do an index and you rank states according to economic competitiveness. Everybody loves a horse race. So tell us, who are the top five, top 10? What states are doing the best in your ranking?
Well, this has been a predictable story for some time now, Loman, at least at the top of the rankings, in that the state of Utah has been a state that has been number one for all 11 editions of Rich States, Poor States. They were recently joined in the top by Idaho, a state that I mentioned just recently is a state that leveraged federal tax reform and had their biggest tax cuts in 25 years on income taxes in this last year. Indiana, a state that was middle of the road just maybe 5 years ago, now is at number three. North Dakota and Arizona round up the top five. But these are states that are serious about keeping costs down, keeping business environments good. And as a result, they've seen some very good economic outcomes in terms of in-migration, job creation, and wage growth.
Conversely, let's take a look at the bottom five or six states.
Well, probably not a lot of surprises on the bottom of this list either. New York, 50th out of 50, has been that way for nearly every edition of Rich States, Poor States. And now, even in recent weeks, where you've had Governor Andrew Cuomo complain that they've had this out-migration of people and businesses out of the state, even Andrew Cuomo is now realizing, I think, that New York is a high-cost place to do business. And so that's not a surprise, not being a right-to-work state, having some of the highest corporate and personal income taxes, not to mention property and sales in America. Vermont, Bernie Sanders' home, has been at 49 for many of our years of our report. But one thing interesting to note, Loman, about Vermont is they even cut taxes this last year because of the surplus revenues that were sitting there from the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So it wasn't just a red state phenomenon. Even Bernie Sanders' Vermont used that opportunity to cut income taxes this last year. And then we have Illinois, California, and New Jersey. New Jersey, of course, is a state that will probably be falling further in the rankings, as just this last week or two, we saw Governor Phil Murphy sign a $15 an hour minimum wage bill into law, making New Jersey even more expensive for job creators.
We have been talking with Jonathan Williams, who is chief economist and vice president of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at the American Legislative Exchange Council. And Jonathan, tell us a little bit about ALEC and also, again, give us the website where folks can go to read the Rich States, Poor States report.
ALEC has been around now for 45 years, created to be an organization that spreads best practices, realizing that we don't have horses in the races across state capitals, that we are there to talk about conservative, free markets, limited government, federalism are our three guiding principles, but we're nonpartisan. We work with legislators across the board, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Libertarian, Vegetarian, and our website is richstatespoorstates.org, where you can go to download the new 11th edition of Rich States, Poor States for free, and it also gives you access to all previous editions of the report, so you can see not only where states rank in 2019, but all of the last 11 editions of the report.
Jonathan Williams, who is co-author of Rich States, Poor States, also chief economist and vice president of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at ALEC. Jonathan, thank you for being with us.
Always great to be with you, my friend.
And now we go to the offices of the Club for Growth, where Scott Parkinson has been watching all the activity on Capitol Hill, and it has been a busy time. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about something that happened over the last week or so and is going to become a major issue through the spring and into the summer. And this has to do with the size of the federal debt and the debt limit. What was the big milestone?
For the first time in U.S. history, the national debt officially passed $22 trillion. And that's historic because if you look back to when President Bush was leaving office, the debt limit had barely passed $10 trillion. So since the beginning of 2009, we've added $12 trillion to the national debt, and we're right back in the middle of another $1 trillion deficit for this fiscal year.
As we head into March and then later this summer, explain for our listeners, Scott, why this whole debt limit issue is not only important, but we sort of are going to be at a critical juncture once again, are we not?
Yeah, we are. What happens in March is the debt limit suspension is officially expired, and we will see the U.S. Treasury Department go through what is called extraordinary measures, where they can sell off assets and find ways to make sure that there's no default on the national debt. The period of extraordinary measures can normally last several months, so we're expecting the debt limit fight to really become a big issue in June and July this summer. What I think you'll see is the Democrat House of Representatives pass a budget resolution that will include a version of what's known as the Gephardt Rule, and that allows the debt limit to be increased by the amount of the deficit that the budget provides for. All that would be necessary after passage of the budget resolution would be for the Senate to take that up and tack it on to some hidden legislation and what's known as a budget deemer and pass the debt limit that fashion. So what we're concerned about here is that there's really no focus on the spending here in Washington. We've been really irresponsible with the taxpayers' money, and we need to have a real serious discussion about what the future of our economy looks like if we keep stacking on trillions and trillions of dollars to the national debt.
Speaking of tacking on those trillions and trillions of dollars, Scott, this exponential increase in the federal debt and the acceleration of it, at what point do we simply run out of the ability to borrow money in those quantities? Somewhere there's got to be a finite number of dollars available.
Certainly the credit agencies are paying attention to the amount of revenue that the Treasury Department annually collects. We're at historic levels of revenue, so that's a good thing if you're concerned about how much we're bringing in and the growth of the economy. But on the other side, we continue to spend way more than we actually have. So there needs to be fiscal restraint and a refocus on the spending side of the budget ledger. I think that we're nearing a point where the credit agencies could warn about another credit downgrade like we saw in 2011. We had a AAA rating that had been downgraded for the first time in U.S. history about 8 years ago, and we're certainly back in a similar situation here where I think everybody should be concerned.
In terms of spending, as we look at this mounting federal national debt, we have in the U.S. Congress the ultra-left wing proposing this so-called Green New Deal, which includes, among other things, Medicare for all. And the cost of these programs is astounding. Can you just talk for a minute or two, Scott, about what's included in this Green New Deal and why, at least financially, it's really unreasonable and unworkable?
The Green New Deal includes the socialist wish list of policy agenda. What we have here is not just Medicare for All, which has about a $40 trillion price tag over 10 years, but we've also got free food for everyone, free housing, living wage for families, even if you're unwilling to work. This is mandate that all structures and buildings in the United States are upgraded so that they're green efficient. That would be devastating for U.S. families and also for employers, if you think about it. Think about tearing down and rebuilding an office building, disrupting work, and retrofitting all these offices. That could cost $20,000 to $100,000 or more in expenses. That's going to mean layoffs. It's going to mean dramatic decrease in productivity. Everybody would be impacted by that, and the economic downtrend that would follow would create economic unrest in the rest of the world. So this really is a concerning agenda that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey from Massachusetts have put out there. I think that the reason it's going to be a big debate here in Washington, even when they vote on it in about 2 weeks in the Senate, is there are six United States senators that are running for president that have already come out and endorsed the legislation. Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, Kirsten Gillibrand, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren are all supporting the Green Dream or the Green New Deal, whatever you prefer to call it. So we're going to continue to put the pressure on them, and I think what you'll see from the Club for Growth in the coming weeks and months are a series of white papers and opinion editorials where we break down what each of these socialist policies would do to the U.S. economy.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us just a bit about the club, also where folks can go to read about all these issues and also keep an eye on all these white papers that are going to be coming up on the Democrat socialist agenda.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 250,000 members from all across the country and all 50 states in the union. Our organization is united with our membership because we all believe in economic freedom. And if your listeners are interested, they can go to our website, www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Howard Schultz, the former CEO of Starbucks, roiled the political waters when he announced he is considering a run for the presidency as an independent. But could he end up as the nominee of the Libertarian Party? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Matt Welch about the possibility. Eric?
Howard Schultz, better known as the CEO of Starbucks, he wants to run for president, but he doesn't want to run as a Republican or a Democrat, and quite frankly, who can blame him? But that is stirring some speculation that he could end up possibly running on the Libertarian Party ticket in 2020. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine, and you're listening to American Radio Journal. My guest today is Matt Welch. He's an editor-at-large with Reason, and he's been following all this intrigue surrounding the Libertarian Party as it heads into 2020. It's the only other party, besides the two big ones, that will have ballot access in all 50 states for the next election. Now, most of that intrigue has to do with whether Bill Weld, who was the party's VP candidate in 2016, whether he's going to jump ship to become a Republican again. But Matt has also been reading some of the tea leaves about Howard Schultz's presidential run, and he joins us on the phone now from Brooklyn, New York, to discuss that. Matt, thanks for taking some time and being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, let's start off by talking a little bit about Schultz and this prospective run for the Oval Office, and maybe let's start with why he might appeal to Libertarian voters heading into 2020.
Well, like whoever the Libertarian Party candidate will be, unless, of course, it's John McAfee, Schultz is foregrounding in his campaign the national debt. saying, look, we're $22 trillion in debt. This is crazy. What's wrong with you people? The Libertarian candidate will do that. Like the Libertarian Party, he's running against, you know, the duopoly and the extreme right and the extreme left, or however you want to put it, and he's appealing to kind of an independent-minded group. And the two sides have something each other want, which is to say the Libertarian Party is going to have ballot access in all 50 states and District of Columbia, most likely, and that's an expensive proposition for an individual to have. And meanwhile, Howard Schultz has a whole lot of money, and Libertarian Party never has any money. I mean, they have an annual budget of $2 million. He can blow his nose and get more than that. But there's all kinds of ideological and recent historical grounds from which it would not.
It really does seem like there's this question of sort of practicality versus ideology. This kind of dogs the Libertarian Party every 4 years. As you said, Matt, the LP has the ballot access. Schultz has plans to spend a lot of money, maybe as much as $500 million, according to some reports, on this race. But ideology matters a lot to libertarians, and it's not even just ideology, really. It's sort of some basic policy disagreements here that Schultz would have to overcome to convince the LP to give him a chance if he was even interested in doing that.
Howard Schultz was on a CNN town hall on Tuesday evening that a million people tuned into, so there's interest out there, even if they're hate-watching from the Democratic point of view, because they think that he's going to hurt their ability to dethrone Donald Trump. But anyways, he's been walking around criticizing Trump. One of his first lines of critique is that of Trump withdrawing troops from Syria or wanting to withdraw troops from Syria. He's dead set against that and says things that I think are just not true, like if we pull troops from Syria, that means Russia has a, quote, stranglehold, unquote, on the Middle East, which seems to be rather hyperbolic. He is being advised in this run or this thinking about running period, because he hasn't fully announced yet, by Steve Schmidt, who's an old campaign manager for John McCain, certainly one of the most interventionist leading figures in Washington for decades. This worries me as someone who shares a lot of the critique of Donald Trump that Howard Schultz or other people have had, or even Bill Kristol have had. I don't want Never Trumpism to be hawkishness, because that's one of the one things where Trump is legitimately promising. He's trying to get us out of Afghanistan, or at least he's expressed that desire several times. Howard Schultz's presidency is not interested in that at all. And Libertarian Party and their members, they are especially motivated by that sense of foreign policy and thinking that America is overextended. So I think that plus his view on guns, which he calls the guns of war that he wants to remove from the streets, that's going to be, I think, a no-fly zone for too many libertarians.
We are talking with Matt Welch, editor-in-large at Reason Magazine, and we are talking about Howard Schultz's prospective presidential campaign. Just about a minute left here, Matt, but I'm curious where you think this all ends up. If Schultz doesn't end up in the libertarian camp for what sound like some pretty good reasons, does he just self-fund an independent campaign? Does he look at the poll numbers and drop out before things even get started? How does this all shake out in your mind?
There's a reason why billionaires don't run every time. I mean, people are complaining, oh, billionaires, they're always getting in the way. Well, there's really only been one. Ross Perot did it in 92 and 96. Billionaires don't like to waste money and throw it down a hole. My sense of it in watching his performance is that he wants to prevent the Democrats from nominating a progressive. He wants to actually have influence on the Democratic primary. He has this incoherent idea that if I have any chance of hurting the ability to dethrone Donald Trump, I'm going to get out of the race and this kind of thing. Well, that doesn't really make any sense if you're an independent. But he is there to say, hey, look, the Green New Deal is pie-in-the-sky stuff that's going to drive people to the likes of me. So I think he's going to be a ghost haunting the primary process, and depending on how that goes, if they go Elizabeth Warren, I think he puts his hat in the ring and sees a lane there. If they go Joe Biden or Sherrod Brown or Amy Klobuchar or someone who's perceived as more centrist, I think he withdraws from the whole thing, maybe throws some money down on the election, but doesn't waste $500 million.
Howard Schultz is not a Democrat. He's not a Republican. He's probably not going to be a Libertarian, but he's still one of the more interesting and intriguing figures as the 2020 presidential field forms up here in the early months of 2019. That is unfortunately all the time that we have for today. Matt, thanks for taking some time and being here.
Thanks, Eric.
And again, that's Matt Welch. He's a colleague of mine at Reason Magazine. You can read his latest piece on Schultz. The headline, "Will Howard Schultz Really Run as a Libertarian? Don't Bet on It." That's up at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bam. Catch us right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
President Trump says the United States will never be a socialist country. Democratic socialists responded by introducing their Green New Deal. Dr. Paul Kingor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
One of the most memorable moments of Donald Trump's presidency is sure to be his 2019 State of the Union address, where he denounced socialism. "Here in the United States, we are alarmed by new calls to adopt socialism in our country," said Trump. "Tonight, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country." It was a revealing signature moment for President Trump, but it was also a revealing signature moment for the Democratic Party. To their credit, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer applauded, as did a decent number of Democrats. Of course, they didn't exactly get out the pom-poms. Nancy clapped lightly from her seat. Still, the fact that they displayed approval at all surprised me. It also confused me for this reason. If they don't want America to become a socialist country, then why aren't they doing more to spare their Democratic Party from socialism? As a case in point, look no further than the reactions of two Democratic Party stars who proudly carry the socialist banner. Every camera in that chamber for the State of the Union caught an agitated Bernie Sanders visibly uncomfortable with Trump's rebuke of socialism. Bernie looked like he was itching to leap to his feet and condemn Trump as a capitalist reptile, an enemy of the proletariat. Likewise uneasy and sitting there stone-faced was Miss Socialist USA, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Backed by a Twitter army of the largest array of socialist geeks since Eugene Debs. She's one of many members of the Democratic Socialists of America, the self-described largest socialist organization in the United States, elected in November 2016. These DSA members ran not on a DSA ticket, but the Democratic Party ticket. Seated not far from Ocasio-Cortez was a fellow DSA socialist-turned-Democrat, the delightful Congresswoman Tlaib, who, shortly after her swearing-in ceremony, publicly vowed, quote, "We're going to impeach the blankety-blank," to a room full of stomping, whooping progressives. They were hardly the only two Democrats with socialist sympathies at the State of the Union. You couldn't have swung a red flag without hitting another nestled somewhere in that chamber. So if Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi don't want America to become a socialist country, then they ought to stop their party from becoming a socialist party, especially if it continues to give a lifetime socialist like Bernie Sanders 13 million votes in the Democratic primary. Gee, Donald Trump got 14 million in the Republican primary, and that was a record for a Republican. Finishing as runner-up in 2016 presumably makes Bernie the Democrat frontrunner for 2020, if Hillary doesn't run. And beyond that, Democrats, addicted like junkies to identity politics, are already hooked on running Ocasio-Cortez for president the day the gal turns age eligible. In fact, if Chuck and Nancy don't want America to become socialist, then someone needs to get a memo to the head of their party, DNC chair Tom Perez. Perez enthuses that the 29-year-old Ocasio-Cortez, quote, "represents the future of our party," unquote. Really, Chairman Perez? A socialist is the future of your party? What would Harry Truman and Jack Kennedy think about that? The answer is that they'd be stunned. Again, I was pleased to see Nancy and Chuck apparently approve of our president's insistence that America not become socialist. Now, it's time to do something about their own party becoming socialist. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my books, Dupes and the Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KHII-FM in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Welcome to our new listeners in the land of enchantment. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.